Where'd this rule book leave off? Okay, we'll resume correcting this now. Let's maybe wait a minute, make sure everybody's here. This is the harder part, I think.
Yeah.
Get an amen to that. I wrote part of it, and Greg Thiel wrote part of it. You know, we've, over the years, modified it and so forth. So, yeah. These have been worked a lot. These tests have been worked and reworked and so forth. So, we're trying to get all the bugs out of them. I think we're pretty close. Yeah, we've been really working on those. So, theology tests are hard to write. They're among the hardest things. My Greek and Hebrew classes are easy to write tests, you know. Everything's yay or nay, you know. And theology is a lot more difficult, especially when you got typology and things to deal with. Okay, question number two then. And you see the point values here. And I'll just run through and list the ones that should be checked. This is dealing with the points in the Abrahamic covenant. A should be checked. He will be father of many nations. That should be checked. B, all families of the earth will be blessed. That should be checked. C should be blank. There's no requirement to tithe his goods to the Lord. He did pay tithes to Melchizedek, but that was voluntary. There was no requirement as far as the covenant. D, those blessing him would be blessed. That should be checked. E, the covenant would be an unconditional covenant. This one's a little tricky. I'm going to give you credit either way on this, just because of the fact that actually, in one sense, there's no condition stated. God just made it. And it's an unconditional covenant in that respect. However, when you really think about it, there were some conditions involved because God did say that he knew Abraham, that he would raise his children and so forth. So it gets to be a kind of a nasty one. So I'm going to give you credit either way. Everybody gets E right. Either way you had it. Okay? Well, I don't know. It's just, that's what's so hard. You know, I think I'd be inclined in some respects in connections with typology and with the New Testament, I would say it's unconditional. Just because of the fact that in the New Testament, there's a point made about the Abrahamic covenant being a promise and so forth, and that the law afterward could not disannul it. And so in that respect, I would say unconditional. On the other hand, you have to be careful because the Calvinist likes to jump on that. Unconditional covenant and so forth. They like that kind of thing, but there are some implied conditions as far as God's foreknowledge and so forth is concerned. So it kind of depends on who I'm talking to, which way I'm going to say that. Okay, got to be careful. Yeah, right. Okay. Now, F, God would be a God to him and to his seed. That should be checked. G should be checked. Great nation be born of him. H, he would be priest of the Most High God. That should be blank. That was Melchizedek. There's no evidence that Abraham was ever a priest. I, multitude of his seed would be as the dust of the earth. That should be checked, definitely. His seed would never be in affliction. That should be blank. God told him specifically that they'd be in 400 years in affliction. K, his seed would possess the gate of his enemies. That's definitely to be checked. L, Abraham's name would be great. That should be checked. M, covenant would be an everlasting covenant. That should be checked for sure. Canaan would be an inheritance. That should be checked. N, and O should be checked. Kings would be born of him, born from him. Okay, that was definitely one of the promises. So let me just to summarize this. You should have them all checked except C should be blank. E could be either way. H should be blank. And J should be blank. All the rest should be checked. Okay, scoring, 1 wrong minus 1, 2 wrong minus 2, 3 wrong minus 3, 4 wrong minus 5, 5 wrong minus 7, 6 wrong minus 8, 7 wrong more minus 9. Okay, then set 3 here. This is worth 6 points. And how do we know that it was wrong for Abraham to leave Canaan during the famine and sojourn in another land? Okay, this A, he was not putting his trust in God to provide. That should be checked. B, the foreign land was a type of the world. I'm going to take either one on this, too, just because of the way things could be defined in typology. In typology, in one respect, you can certainly say that the foreign land was a type of the world, but there's a problem in that Abraham did not fully possess any land yet.
And so that makes it a little bit more difficult. So I'm going to accept it either way on that. B could be either checked or blank. C should be checked. D should be checked. E should be blank. F should be checked. And the last four of them should all be blank. Those are all just made up answers. Okay. So A should be checked. B should be either checked or blank. C and D should be checked. And F should be checked. And the rest are blank. Okay, six total points. One wrong minus one, two wrong minus four, three wrong minus five, four or more minus six. Okay. That brings us to the matching. And there's three sets of six. Each one of them is worth 6 points. In other words, there's 1 point for every response. So each letter is worth a point. Number one, under set number one, Tara, number one should be C. Means delay. Number two, Lot should be F. F. Number three, Eliezer should be J. Got his help. Number four, Haran should be D. D as in dog, meaning parched or dry. Number five, Melchizedek is B as in boy, king of righteousness. And number six is A, teacher of instruction, Moreh. I'll repeat that one more time. Number one should be C. Number two, F. Number three, J. Number four, D. Number five, B. Number six, A. Okay, the second set, all worth 1 point also, in other words, 1 point each. Abraham should be K, father of multitude. Number two, Abram should be C, high father. Number three, Ishmael should be I, God hears. Number four, Isaac should be E, laughter. Number five, Jacob should be J, supplanter. And number six, Esau should be D, rough or hairy, D. 1 point each. I'll repeat that again. Number one is K, number two C, number three I, number four E, number five J, and number six D. Okay, then the third set, number one should be C. Hagar means flight or to flee, C. Number two, Sarah should be I, princess. That's the meaning of the Hebrew. Now, it also says in the verse that she was to be a mother of a multitude, but that's not the meaning of the Hebrew name. The Hebrew name means princess. Okay, number three, Edom is A, the red one, A. Number four, Rebekah is B, as in boy, to ensnare by beauty. And number five, Abimelech should be J, father of the king, J. Okay, subtract the number of points from 95. If it's a perfect paper, put 95 at the top. Please don't try to convert to percentage, unless you've got a computer with you or some calculator. And even then, I'd rather that you didn't do it. I'll just do it quickly myself. 95 is perfect paper. Subtract the points from 95. Then you can pass it back to the owner and take a look at your paper to make sure the addition is correct. Double check it. Because I'll assume it's correct when I go through them. Okay, once you're satisfied the score's correct, you can pass the papers to the front and we'll have someone collect them across the front here. Yeah, subtract the number wrong from 95. The total. How much information there is in this book of Genesis. It's a lot of the history of the world here. Yeah. Okay, Joe? Yeah, if you have a question about the test, why don't you see me at break about it? I'd rather take those then. Okay? Okay, just pass them to the front, Dennis. We'll have some we'll collect them across the front here. And then you can turn to Genesis 31 and we'll resume our discussion here. About these ring-straight cattle.
trying to figure out the curve here, huh?
Okay, we have old David yet? Got a few floating out there, yeah.
Three and a half years in relationship to the death of Sarah. Yeah, I'd have to check here and get the exact figure on that. I don't want to just say it off the top of my head. Yeah, it probably would be after Isaac was born to get the typology. I remember we did a lot of number crunching. Oh, from the sacrifice, yeah. From the sacrifice. Yeah, I think I've got it here. Okay. Sarah died at age 127. She was 123 and a half when Isaac was offered on Mount Moriah. So she dies 3.5 years after Mount Moriah, after the, in type, the man-child is taken up. Of course, he wasn't actually taken up, but that would be the condition. Right. Yeah, it would be in the later type. Okay, we have all the papers now? Still got some coming there, huh?
All right.
I'll just set those there. You can put those there when you get them all. Okay. We can hold on.
If you have any more floating out there, bring them up after break.
Okay. Genesis 31 and verse 10 is whereabouts the point that we left off. And Jacob is talking about the miracle that God did in order to provide him with great wealth and the miracle with the cattle and the birth of the cattle with the colored and striped and so forth, multicolored. And verse 10, and it came to pass at the time that the cattle conceived that I lifted up mine eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the cattle were ringstrakes, speckled and grizzled. And the angel of God spake unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and he said, Here am I. And he said, Lift up now thine eyes and see, all the rams which leap upon the cattle are ringstrakes, speckled and grizzled, for I have seen all that Laban hath done unto thee. Now, Jacob has a dream here about this thing that took place. And it's not easy to tell exactly when the dream came. I'll get into that in just a moment. But it says here in verse 10 that he saw the rams. I think we were mentioning before, the Hebrew is literally he-goats here rather than rams. And the problem is that the word for cattle is really the same as for sheep and so forth, small cattle. And so it's the he-goats and so forth. We're just talking specifically about the goats, but the principle applies to all the other kinds of animals that he receives. This phrase leaped upon is a reference to mating. So the ones that in the dream were mating with the others were pictured in the dream as being ring-straked and spotted and speckled and so forth. And this is what he saw in the dream. And he said, the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, so forth. And he said, behold, lift up thou thine eyes and see the rams which leap upon the cattle are ring-straked, speckled, and grizzled. Now, in reality, of course, in the actual happening of it, all the cattle were solid-colored because part of the deal was to take all the ring-straked ones out, and still he would get the ones that were born that way. But in the dream, he sees it as the ring-straked ones bringing forth, and the point is that God is showing him in the dream what's going to happen. He's showing him in a dream that it's ring-straked ones that are bringing forth, and they're going to bring forth after their kind. They're going to bring forth the speckled and spotted ones. And although in the actual reality of the thing, it was not animals that were spotted or speckled that were allowed to bring forth, but it was ones that were solid. But God's showing in the dream that they're going to come out just as if their parents were ring-straked. So that's the point. The dream was a revelatory dream showing them how God was going to do it. Now, it's hard to tell for sure when this dream occurred,
It says here, when the cattle, he leads in verse 10, it came to pass that at the time the cattle conceived, that I lifted up mine eyes and saw in a dream. So apparently it was after this had happened, and God is giving him an explanatory dream to show that it wasn't his maneuvering with the sticks that produced this result. It was the blessing of God. And of course, we've maintained that point before. Now, it's possible that God may have selected the animals that were heterozygous. Now, some of you that know something about genetics, this gets a little technical, but even though all the cattle were solid-colored, many of them had recessive genes for spotted and so forth. And so all God would have to do is select the ones that were heterozygous and cause the probabilities and choose the probabilities of the gene combinations and have them all come out a certain way. In other words, God can load the dice a little bit as far as the genetic probability of certain things coming forth. And that's no doubt what he did, although he's got a lot of other options too. He can just change the whole genetic system if he wants, but it's that would be the most reasonable thing to suspect. And God did it because he saw what Laban was trying to do. So God is able to turn things around and bless his people in spite of what anybody else is doing. That's something to remember. In spite of the way the world may treat God's people, the way other churches may treat us, or anything else, God's able to bless. And in spite of the hostility, we had a number of dissidents that vowed to destroy Community Chapel and do everything that was in their power to destroy us. And God told us that as they were praying against us, God was going to use it to bless us. And we have never been so blessed at Community Chapel in all of our history since that time. We've had more revival, more blessing, and so forth than we've ever had. We've always had blessing, but it's been even better since that time. So God knows how to bless. He sees what the enemy's trying to do to us, and so he just turns it to our good. That's what happened to Jacob here. Okay, verse 13. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Now arise, and get thee out from this land, and return to the land of thy kindred. So God is giving him instruction now to get back to the land of his kindred, and he had to return now. He said, where thou vowest a vow unto me. See, Jacob had promised that he would come back to this land at Bethel there, and he'd made a vow, and now God's holding him to it. He says, get back to the land that I've called you to. Verse 14, and Rachel and Leah answered and said unto him, is there yet a portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Okay, so she's saying, is there any more portion in our father's house? And the implied answer is no, that's it. It's time to leave. And it's the bride in type being joined to Christ and separated from the world. There's no more portion in her father's house. There's nothing more in this world. And it's time to leave. It's time to make that separation. Verse 15, are we not counted of him strangers? For he hath sold us and hath quite devoured us also our money. So they recognize that there's nothing left there, and their father has really devoured them. He sold us, in effect. In other words, it's showing the resentment on their part of how their father had essentially sold them for 14 years' service, sold one daughter for 7 years and then the next one for 7 years. And Laban really should have treated this payment like a dowry to provide a financial base for his daughters. That's usually what the dowry was for, is to provide some source of income and a solid basis for the daughter's future. But instead, he takes it all to himself. And so they look at it as if he sold them just for his own gain, which is really true. Okay. And so he says, for he hath quite devoured also our money. So he's taken all the money that he would have gotten from this labor and didn't send it with his daughters to provide a basis for their new life, but kept it himself. Verse 16, for all the riches which God hath taken from our father, that is ours, and our children's, now then whatsoever God hath said unto thee, do. So their feeling to Jacob is, whatever you want to do, do. We're kind of fed up with our father and what he's done. And they felt that God had restored what rightfully belonged to them through this thing with the cattle. And so now it's been paid, and now it's time to go. They don't really expect Laban to be dealing favorably with them anymore, and they're willing to leave. Verse 17, then Jacob rose up and set his sons and his wives upon camels. And he carried away all his cattle and his goods which he had gotten, the cattle of his getting, which he had gotten in Padan Aram, for to go to Isaac his father in the land of Canaan. This phrase, carried away, in the Hebrew means drove away. It's indicating urgency and haste. He drove away all his cattle and so forth. It wasn't just leading him away or carrying away, it was driving him. Now, we have another problem that arises here. Verse 19, and Laban went to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the images that were her father's. This word images in the Hebrew is teraphim, T-E-R-A-P-H-I-M. This is the plural for teraph, which would be the singular. Teraphim were small figurines that were used in divination and as household deities that were supposed to bring good luck. So they had little images that they could keep in their house and this type of thing among the pagans and so forth, and their false deities. And we see that kind of thing even later on, many years later, with the Ephesians. The goddess Diana of the Ephesians was a goddess that they worshipped, and each person could have their own little tiny shrine of Diana to take with them wherever they went, put in their home and so forth, to worship her at home. And that was where the silversmiths were making their money, making these little shrines. And when the gospel was preached, people were getting converted. Nobody was wanting those shrines anymore, and the silversmiths were really up in arms about their trade, most of all. They weren't as worried about Diana as they were about their selling these little images. Well, these teraphim, then, were images of some sort, and supposed to bring good luck. Rachel probably trusted Jacob's God, but she was reluctant to completely give up her previous superstitions and idolatry. Remember, she grew up in this household, and so she had been ingrained with these kinds of teachings. Now that Jacob comes along and he's teaching her about something, the true God, she's probably believing that, but it's awful hard to break from tradition and break from things you've been taught. And it's a type of those who come to Christ, but they still hang on to things in the world. They still hang on to some things that they had before. Don't make a clean break. And may not even always understand what the significance of some of those things are. So, possibly also, there's another element involved here. Some of the archaeological investigations, especially the Nuzu tablets that were excavated around 1930, is when the excavations took place. They've discovered a lot of information about the patriarchal times. And they claim that the teraphim were associated with the inheritance and the property rights of their owner as well. So to have the teraphim was a sign of having the inheritance and the property rights and so forth. And so that may have, if that be the case, Rachel may have stolen them with the thought that possessing them would validate the legitimacy of her husband's title to the flocks that he'd acquired, you know, that he'd have a right to this property. So that's possible that may have been in her mind also, that she wasn't just trying to keep these things to worship, but it was because of the property rights and the legitimizing the property rights that she had. That's a possibility. Okay, verse 20. And Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, in that he told him not that he fled. So he did this secretly. In other words, he fled from Laban secretly. And verse 21, so he fled with all that he had, and he rose up and passed over the river and set his face toward Mount Gilead. He says here, passed over the river. The river is no doubt the Euphrates River. It is a big river, but it is shallow enough in certain points to wade across. And so just saying the river without qualification is usually a reference to the Euphrates River. So he's crossing the Euphrates and heading west, heading toward Mount Gilead. Mount Gilead would be the mountainous region east of the Jordan River. So he's heading for the region east of the Jordan River, and then, of course, eventually into Canaan. Verse 22. And it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob was fled. And he took his brethren with him and pursued after them 7 days' journey. And they overtook him in the Mount Gilead. And God came to Laban the Syrian in dream by night and said to him, take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. So God warns Laban in a dream. And these dreams must have been pretty powerful dreams, because these are men that are going to change the course of their conduct on the basis of a dream. And, you know, people have lots of dreams and have weird dreams about this or that, and they usually don't act on them when they wake up. So this was a pretty powerful and pretty straightforward message, like with Abimelech and some of the others before. So he says, take heed, and it shows something. It indicates that Laban intended to take the flocks away from Jacob by force, if necessary, possibly also to kill Jacob. He's probably pretty upset about this. And God warns him and stops him before he does anything drastic. And he says to say nothing good or bad. In other words, nothing for the purpose of altering Jacob's decision, not trying to talk him out of what he decided to do. Verse 25, then Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount. And Laban with his brethren pitched in the mount of Gilead. I think we'll go on here a couple more verses, or next verse. And Laban said to Jacob, what hast thou done that thou hast stolen away unawares to me and carried away my daughters as captives, taken with a sword? Well, his real concern, no doubt, is getting the flocks back, but he won't say that because of God's warning. And God warned him not to say anything positive or negative about that. So he talks about his daughters and so forth as if he's still upset here. And he's having to talk about his daughters now rather than what he's really concerned about. Verse 27, wherefore didst thou flee away secretly and steal away from me, and didst not tell me, that I might have sent thee away with mirth and with songs and with tabret and with harp? And this is no doubt a lie. It's hard to imagine that Laban was going to have a big celebration and rejoice that Jacob was going to take all his flocks and leave. So this is just the way the devil talks. It sounds something like what the communists would say after the United States walks out of some arms agreement talks or something like that, and make it sound as though we have been treated them so ill, and if we'd just stayed there, they would have been so gracious to us. Okay, verse 28. And hast not suffered me to kiss my sons and daughters. Thou hast now done foolishly in so doing. Verse 29. It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. But the God of your father spake unto me like yesternight, saying, Take thou heed that thou speak not unto Jacob either good or bad. Notice the way he refers to God, the God of your father. He does not acknowledge Yahweh as his own God. And so he's still staying with a pagan. He's still pagan himself, but he says, Yahweh, your God. And remember, these pagans, even though it was a different God, they feared other nations' gods too. They believed every nation had their own gods, and they would have contests between one another's gods and that type of thing, see who is the strongest. So it's not a matter of the fact that he was a pagan himself does not mean that he did not acknowledge the existence of the God of the true God of Israel, but he probably thought of that God as just another one of the polytheistic deities that all nations have. In fact, the next few statements in the context, well, it'll come a little bit later on, may indicate that very thing. Now, he says, the God of your father, and now he's stooping to as far as his heart is concerned, it's to do him ill. It indicates that his heart has changed from the time that Jacob first came. He welcomed Jacob, he loved him and invited him in, and he took in Eliezer years before. But idolatry has taken its toll. His heart and his attitude and so forth has gotten worse and worse with time. Verse 30, And now, though thou wouldst needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my gods? Now he brings up the issue of these teraphim. And he's probably using this as his excuse for pursuing Jacob. He's saying, I'm after you because you stole the teraphim. And he's probably not that concerned about them, though, because, to travel for 7 days to get them, he probably could have picked some more up at the local teraphim shop, And he had lots of money. There wouldn't have been any problem. I mean, to lose a few things, images like this, that wasn't that big of a deal, especially to travel that far. So, but he uses this as an excuse. And he also probably knows Jacob well enough to know he would never steal these idols. Jacob wasn't an idol worshiper, and he didn't have any use for those teraphim. So if they were taken, it wouldn't have been Jacob that took them. And so that wasn't really the primary issue, the thing that he was really worried about. Verse 31, And Jacob answered and said to Laban, Because I was afraid, for I said, Peradventure thou wouldest take by force thy daughters from me. With whomsoever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. Before our brethren discern thou what is thine with me, and take it to thee. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. So he just says, if you find it, if anybody's taken them, they deserve to die, and so forth. He's very confident that he didn't have them. Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the two maidservants' tent, but he found them not. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered into Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the images and put them in the camel's furniture and sat upon them. And Laban searched all the tent, but found them not. The camel's furniture refers to the kind of a saddle with a structure to carry baggage and so forth that they used for the cattle. So it's a saddle and a basket type of assemblage that was used to carry things. And so she's sitting on that on top of the camel there. In verse 35, And she said to her father, Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise up before thee, for the custom of women is upon me. And he searched but found not the images. So she says the custom of women, this is referring to the menstrual period and so forth, and she excused herself for not rising by saying she was not feeling well and so forth because of that. And so that, settled the issue, and he went on. Verse 36, And Jacob was wroth and chode with Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, What is my trespass? What is my sin that thou hast so hotly pursued after me? So Jacob, of course, didn't know anything about the teraphim and so forth, and of course that was only an excuse anyway. And now that he sees that they're not finding anything, he's getting a little bit bolder, and he says he chode with Laban. It means he contended with him. It's an old English word. He contended with him now, and he's beginning to unleash about 20 years of pent-up emotion here. He's going to give quite a long dissertation here. And he's been dealt ill by Laban for a long, long time. Whereas hast thou searched all my stuff, which hast thou found of all the of all thy household stuff? In other words, what have you found of the things that were yours? Set it here before my brethren and thy brethren, that they may judge betwixt us both. This 20 years have I been with thee. Thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten. This word, cast their young, refers to miscarried. In other words, what he's claiming is that he's been very careful with Laban's flocks. He's been careful to take care of them properly so that the females didn't miscarry and cost him more lambs and sheep and so forth. And he says, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten. Now, he never used Laban's animals for his own food while he was caring for them, although that was considered a right of every shepherd to be able to sustain himself from the food of the flocks. But he never did that. In verse 39, that which was torn of beasts I brought not unto thee. I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. In other words, Jacob bore the cost of losses due to wild animals. If wild animals would come in and tear up some of the sheep, it was customary for a shepherd to bring those sheep to the owner to show and prove that an animal had torn them, and therefore he wouldn't have to, you know, pay for it. The owner would cover it. But in this case, Jacob's not doing that either. He bears the loss of it himself. And apparently this is the way that Laban was handling it. Verse 40, thus I was in the day of the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. So he talks about all the things he went through. The drought here is the heat of the day, and the frost by night, and all the conditions that he was under for so many years. Thus have I been 20 years in thy house. I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters, and 6 years for thy cattle. And thou hast changed my wages 10 times. He mentioned that before, how he kept changing it, and so forth when things were going a certain way. Verse 42, except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely thou had sent me away now empty. God hath seen my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked thee yesternight. Okay, so God was, he's just acknowledging to Laban and letting him know that God has been with him. He says the fear of Isaac in reference to God. In other words, it's the God whom Isaac served with fear and reverence. The fear of Isaac doesn't mean that Isaac was terrified and scared to death of God. It's in the sense of reverence and awe. And so it's a godly fear. And this God has been with me, and Laban certainly would have sent him away empty. Verse 43, and Laban answered and said unto Jacob, these daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and these cattle are my cattle, and all thou seest is mine. And what can I do this day unto these my daughters, or to their children which they have borne? So he can't deny Laban's charges or Jacob's charges, but he won't admit his wrong still. So he changes the subject and so forth. How can I hurt my daughters? And these are my daughters and so forth. Now he's changing the argument now from appealing on the basis of his own rights and so forth. But now he's just looking at the children now and trying to make it sound as though he's really concerned for these children. And I'm really worried about what's happening to them. That's the reason why I'm pursuing you and so forth. But the real reason was he lost a lot of wealth. Verse 44, now therefore come thou, let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee. So literally it's let us cut a covenant again. That's the normal Hebrew expression for making a covenant, cutting a covenant, and it usually involves sacrifices and so forth. Here in verse 45, Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. And Jacob said unto his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made an heap, and they did eat there upon the heap. So they had a meal. And that was a token of friendship and covenant and agreement and so forth. And they set up this monument as a memorial and to remember a certain covenant that they're making. So verse 47, and Laban called it Jagar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Now this Jagar Sahadutha is an Aramaic word, means the heap of witness, the heap of witness. So they built a heap of rocks that was for a witness. This Galeed or Galaed in Hebrew is the same, means it has the same basic meaning. So the idea of a heap of witness. Okay, in verse 48, and Laban said, this heap is a witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Galeed, after what Jacob had called it. And verse 49, and Mizpah, for he said, the Lord which watch between me and thee when we are absent from one another. Okay, this word Mizpah means watchtower. And a watchtower, of course, to them was a tower that was built so a person could get up in a high place and watch especially in vineyards and so forth, they had to watch to see if foxes and so forth, animals were coming in and destroying the grapes. And so they'd set up a watchtower for protection there. And so he's saying that this heap is also a watchtower, a symbol of a watchtower, in effect, that God is watching both of them and is going to honor this commitment here that's being made and this promise that Laban is making, and both of them, really. So one more comment here says, the Lord watch between me and thee when we are absent from one another. Now, this word absent, the Hebrew is literally hidden, when we are hidden from one another. And what it apparently is referring to is not so much God watching over you, you know, until we meet again, you know, that type of thing. In fact, this verse has often been used in that kind of a context as a, you know, God will be watching over us till we meet again. But that's not really the tenor. The context here is two hostile parties here, and he's saying that God is going to watch to make sure you keep this covenant. And when you're slinking around and hidden and trying to pull something under covers, as it were, God's going to see it. So that's the thing he's getting at. If God's going to watch this, God's going to honor this. And just let Laban know. See, Laban has already had a dream in which God has come to him. He knows God's real. And Jacob's just reminding him that God is going to watch over this thing, and he's going to honor it. Okay, verse 50. If thou shalt afflict, and see, here's the context. If thou shalt afflict my daughters, or if thou shalt take other wives besides my daughters, no man is with us. See, God is witness betwixt me and thee. Okay, so he says, this is Laban now speaking, if thou shalt afflict my daughters, or if thou shalt take other wives beside my daughters, no man is betwixt us. See, God is witness betwixt me and thee. So Laban himself believes that God is there, and he's got some concern for his daughters here. There is, let me just check one thing here. Okay, it's coming up in a few verses from now. Let's read verses 51 to 53. And Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold this pillar, which I have cast betwixt me and thee. This heap be witness, and this pillar be witness, that I will not pass over this heap to thee, and that thou shalt not pass over this heap and this pillar unto me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge betwixt us. And Jacob sware by the fear of his father Isaac. Now the interesting thing about this verse 53, Laban's speaking now, and he's calling God to witness on this, is the way that he uses the verb. It says, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge betwixt us. The word judge, in the verb judge in Hebrew is plural. And that's unusual because the word God is used with singular verbs and pronouns when it's referring to the true God. But remember who's talking. This is not Jacob talking, this is Laban. And Laban's a polytheist, and he believes in many gods. And so he uses a plural verb because he's attributing to Israel the same polytheism that he believes in. And especially, he may have even, we don't know for sure, but he may have regarded Jacob as believing in one God. But he says the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, to him that may have even been different gods. And the God of their father, or in fact, this last phrase could be translated the gods of their father. The gods plural of their father, because of the fact that he uses the plural judge in a plural form. You might translate the gods of their father just to show that he's thinking polytheistically, speaking of their gods. And their father Terah, of course, believed in many gods and was a polytheist, which he would have been the father of both Nahor and Abraham. So that may have been the way he's looking at it. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the gods of their father, judge betwixt us. He's just calling all the gods that be, you know, to judge here. Just to make sure he includes everybody. It's like the Greeks with their altar to the unknown God. Just make sure they don't leave any out. Okay, verse 54. Then Jacob offered sacrifice upon the mount and called his brethren to eat bread. And they did eat bread and tarried all night in the mount. And early in the morning Laban rose up and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned to his place. So that's the last we hear of Laban, actually, in the scriptures. There's no further mention made of him or of his sons in the scripture from this point on. Yes, Tom. Rob. What's that? Well, it doesn't use Yahweh here. It just uses Elohim. Yeah. And that's the thing. There's a question as to whether, you know, that Elohim could also be taken. As far as Laban's concerned, all of them could be plurals. But it may be, if he understood that Elohim, at least Jacob was considering himself to be monotheistic and attribute that to Abraham, then we could perhaps allow that. Maybe that was his concept for the God of Abraham, but for the God of Nahor, could be God's plural again, and then it uses the plural clearly with a plural verb for the God of their fathers, gods of their fathers. So that's a little bit ambiguous because it's hard to know how to link those things up. He may have thought of them as all polytheistic. We find that with other instances of Scripture where the heathen just attributed, you know, these be the gods, their gods be the gods of the hills and that type of thing. They attributed polytheism. Okay. Any other question there? Yes, Mike? Oh, I think the idea is this, that it's not a man that's judging between us. It's God that's witness. In other words, he's appealing to God, not to men, to be a witness between us. Right. In other words, he's saying that if you go and take other wives besides my daughters and so forth, in other words, his big pretense now is he's been shot down in every other argument. He's got nothing else to appeal to, so he's kind of leaving gracefully, you know, and trying to make it spiritual. And we don't want to be too hard on the fellow. He probably, you know, had some redeeming virtue here. He is calling to God and so forth, and he knows the power of God because of the dream and so forth. So he's saying, in effect, that, well, you know, you be good to my daughters, and if you're not good to them, God is witness. God's watching you. And so it just reminds him that God is watching over him. And it's not a man that's between us, but it's God. God be witness between you and me. So he's probably talking like a believer in the true God for a while, and then when he talks about the God of Nahor and the gods of your fathers and so forth, he starts bringing the polytheistic idea in. But I think especially with regard to Jacob, he knows that Jacob's got a real God. And so he wants to use that leverage over Jacob and say that your God's watching you, be sure and be good to my daughters. I'm sure he didn't even have to say that. I think he had observed for some 20 years the way that Jacob was treating his daughters. And that was never an issue of contention before. It wasn't, Laban wasn't all the time railing on Jacob because he was beating up on his daughters, you know. He wasn't worried about that. But now he's talking like he's worried about that, when the real reason was he's losing all these sheep and oxen and so forth. Okay. Now, Genesis 32, verse 1. Just a few comments before we get started here. Jacob's two great enemies were Laban and Esau. And one was outside the promised land, Laban here, that he's just dealt with. And the other one was within, Esau. And this is typical of the church. Our struggles are both against the world and against the flesh, both against those outside and those inside the covenant who are not walking in the Spirit. And so we see now Jacob's going to, if he's coming back to the land, you know, he's got to face Esau. And Rebekah, remember, had promised to send for Jacob once Esau's wrath had cooled. That's the reason he left in the first place, because Esau was upset at him. And so his mother told him, you go and stay with Laban for a while, then when you come back, I'll send for you as soon as Esau's wrath is cooled. But apparently that never happened. And we have no record that Jacob ever heard from her during his 20-year sojourn in Padan Aram. So Esau is still a worry to the mind of Jacob. He's still wondering what's happened here. He hasn't gotten any clear word. And so that's a big question mark as he's heading back to Canaan's land. Verse 1, and Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. So he went on his way, and there's a type here too. He's drawing nigh unto God, in effect. He's going back to pay his vows. He's going back to the land that God promised him to inherit. And so as he's drawing near to God, God's drawing near to him. Angels meet him on the way. We don't find angels meeting him when he's in Padan Aram. But now that he's on his way back, the angels are there to meet him. And Christians often find that when they begin, if they've backslidden, turned away from God, gotten cold and so forth, they start to make some steps back, and God's there to meet them. He's like that father of the prodigal son that's standing out in the door, you know, in the pathway, looking and longing for us to return. So the angels of God come, and God had opened Jacob's spiritual eyes, allowing him to see the otherwise invisible band of angels here. Angels are normally invisible, but he sees them, and God's opening his eyes spiritually because he's turning to God. Verse 2, and when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host," and he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Machaneh is the word for a camp, and Machanaim would be the dual form, the Hebrew for two camps, literally. Two camps or two companies is what this means. So he calls the name of the place two camps or two companies, and he's probably referring to the fact that he was protected not only by his own small host, his own company, but by another one, an angelic one. So there's two camps or two companies, the angelic and that he sees by faith here in Revelation, and the natural one of his own people and his servants and so forth. Psalm 34:7, the angel of the Lord encamps around about them that fear him and delivers them. So it's a picture of that other camp that we have around about us. Verse 3, And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. So he didn't know what to expect from Esau, so he sends a delegation ahead to find out what Esau's intentions are and to greet him and try to feel out the situation. Verse 4, and he commanded them, saying, thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob thus saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. Notice the way he says, thy servant, addressing Laban, and the message he's telling his servants to give to Esau, is to address him as thy servant. Jacob is wanting peace and reconciliation, so he's using great respect and tactfulness and so forth to try to approach Esau. He comes at him humbly and so forth. But he seems to be going a little bit too far here, probably because of his fear of Esau, because this is almost too much, you know, thy servant and so forth, talking to his brother this way. But he apparently still has a considerable amount of fear concerning Esau. Verse 5, I have oxen and asses and flocks and men servants and women servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find grace in thy sight. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we have come to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him. Okay. So somehow Esau had gotten the word that Jacob was returning to Canaan even before the time. And he was coming out with 400 men to meet him. And of course, Esau didn't know what Jacob's intentions were either. And so there was mistrust between the both. Esau assembled his own army and he came out to meet Jacob. And Jacob's messengers probably ran into Esau well northward of Seir en route to meet Jacob. In other words, they met on the way. As they were going to find Esau, they found Esau coming toward to meet Jacob. And, you know, it's not certain that Esau was openly hostile here. As you see what happens, that may not have been the case. He was just a little bit concerned, too, and wondering what the situation was. Verse 7, and Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two bands. Now, he divided his people into two separate groups. Jacob jumps to the conclusion that Esau was still mad at him and that he was coming to kill him. And so, temporarily forgetting this vision of angels that he had previously gotten, he's taking measures now to try to defend himself, and he divided his group. That was a custom that was quite common when caravans were endangered by thieves or robbers or armies or something of that nature, to split up so that one company could escape while the other one was in battle. And so it was a means to try to spare some at least. So that's the measure that he takes here. Verse 8. And said, if Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company is left, which is left shall escape. So I just explained there, verse 9. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, and Yahweh which said unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Now here, Jacob is praying, and his faith is being tested. And he addresses God now, and he's doing the right thing. He's appealing to God. He's done all he knows to do, and he turns to God now in prayer. And this is Jacob's first recorded prayer. In other words, the first prayer we have recorded of Jacob, and actually it's the first recorded prayer in the Bible. First time in the Bible we have a whole prayer recorded like this. And so notice in his prayer, he comes to Yahweh. He uses the term Yahweh here, and he approaches him as Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God. He says, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, and then he says, Yahweh, which did say unto me, return to thy country. You're the one that made the covenant with me. He reminds God of his promise also, that you said unto me, return unto thy country and also thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. So he's reminding God of his promise. And then he's also acknowledging his own unworthiness. Verse 10, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of the truth which thou showed unto me, thy servant, so forth. This is the proper way to pray, to address God as the covenant-keeping God, to remind God of his promises, and to also acknowledge our own unworthiness and that we are not deserving of these things. Okay. He says, for with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I'm become two bands. So he's just talking about the fact that he's had to split into two groups now. This one more thing I wanted to say, and that's concerning this staff. He's acknowledging his pilgrim status. The staff was symbolic of the fact that he was a nomad. He was a pilgrim. He did not have any certain land. And so He's acknowledging that pilgrim status, although he also acknowledges the blessing of God upon his life. Verses 11 and 12, deliver me, I pray thee, from the band of my brother, from the hand of my brother, and from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou saidst, I will surely do thee good and make thee as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So again, reminding of the promise and expressing his fear and, of the intentions of Esau. He says, thy seed, as the sand of the sea again, we see he's simply not concerned with his own life alone. He's concerned with the promise. He's concerned with the seed. He's concerned with the offspring. And his fear is that if they be annihilated by Esau here, that that promise will never come to pass. And we see that that's one thing about Jacob that's quite consistent from the very beginning. His concern for the birthright, his concern for the long-term blessings. And that's the reason why he wanted to get the birthright in the first place from Esau. And now he's concerned about the fulfillment of that covenant, that promise. Verse 13, and he lodged there that same night and took of that which came into his hand, a present for Esau, his brother. So he's going to try to bring an appeasing gift here to Esau to show his peaceable intentions. And this, of course, was a customary thing as well. Verses 14 and 15 describes the present here. 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 kine, that means cows now, 10 bulls, 20 she-asses, and 10 foals. So this is quite a substantial gift. Total is 580 animals. And it shows the degree to which God had prospered him if he can give that many animals up as a gift. And then he says in verse 16, and he delivered them to the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servants, pass over before me and put a space betwixt drove and drove. Now the droves he's talking about are the groups of animals here. And he says, put a space between drove and drove. What he wants to do is split it up into several different gifts, as it were. So it looks like he's got several gifts to give rather than just one. He gives one and then another and then another and then another in succession in order to make it look like as a bigger gift. Verse 17, and he commanded the foremost, saying, when Esau my brother meeteth thee and asketh thee, saying, whose art thou, and whither goest thou, and whose are these before thee? Then thou shalt say, they be thy servant Jacob's, it is a present sent unto my lord Esau, and behold, also he is behind us. I'll go on here a few more verses. And so commanded he the second and the third and all that followed the drove, saying, On this manner shall ye speak unto Esau when ye shall find him. And say ye moreover, behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goeth before me, and afterward I will see his face, peradventure he will accept me. So he's trying to soften him up with gift after gift after gift, having him come in several groups in order to appease the wrath of his brother. And actually, this word appease him in verse 20, the Hebrew is literally, I will cover his face with the offering. I will cover his face is the idea that they're saying. And it's referring to the covering of the face of an offended person so that he can no longer see the offense. He's trying to cover him up. In other words, he's been offended, and he's trying to cover up the offense with all these gifts so that the offended can't see the real cause and the problem. He's so happy to get the gifts that he forgets about why he's mad. Okay, we'll stop there. Yes, that's a 5-minute break. So we'll take a 5-minute break now and continue this, find out what happens.